Pushkin.
Lay it on me, baby. Lay it on me till it gets right under my skin. And the merry mood I'm in.
Nick Lowe grew out of England's pub rock scene to write some of the smartest songs of the new wave era. His classics, like So It Goes, I Love the Sound of Breaking Glass, and Cruel to Be Kind, stand up with any of the best songs of the time. And he's still going. Nick Lowe's newest EP, Lay It On Me, comes out June 5th and shows he's still the strong songwriter he always was.
Something fundamental to me that I can almost taste. When I get with it,
Nick Lowe established himself early by writing and producing one of the UK's early punk singles for The Damned, produced Elvis Costello's first five albums, co-founded one of my favorite record labels, Stiff Records, and wrote the classic, What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding. Nick talked to Bruce Hedlund about all of this, plus what it was like marrying into Johnny Cash's family, and a hilarious first encounter with Keith Richards. This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond. Here's Bruce Hedlund and Nick Lowe from GSI Studios in Brooklyn. This interview was taped while Nick was on tour with Los Straitjackets.
So why don't we start with one of your new songs?
Oh, okay, yeah. Last night was the last night of our tour. I've been on tour with the Straitjackets, so... Mm-hmm.
Play us a song that you've recorded with them recently.
Okay, this is one. This is called Love Starvation. I'll do my best to do it.
Hugging my pillow all alone in a rickety bed. Baby, if it's any consolation, the needle's in red. It only hit me when I went by a mirror. That's when I saw what was written all over my face. I'm suffering love starvation, a very bad case. Tell you something about love starvation. It's like a prison in your mind you're locked up in. Disappointment, desperation, your two old friends. Make it stop. If only I could turn back the clock. Make it so, cause I tell you that I can't exist in a world like this. Stop, if only I could turn back the clock. Make it so, cause I tell you that I can't exist in a world like this. I woke up early with love starvation, hugging my pillow all alone in a rickety bed. Baby, if it's any consolation, the needle's in the red. The needle's in the red. Love starvation. Got me on the back foot. It's put me in a dark and lonely place. It's got me never knowing if I'm ever going to start living again. Love starvation, baby. Love, 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 love,
Can you tell me the inspiration for that song?
Well, I was doing some recording with the Straitjackets in New York City last year, And we came back from the studio. We'd had a pretty good day. We came back from the studio. And I just thought we needed a song in that tempo. That sort of tempo, kind of Bobby Fuller 4, Ritchie Valens kind of tempo. Sort of 60s Hully Gully beat. Mm-hmm. You know, I could hear them doing it. And when I got back to the UK, I woke up one morning with this title, Love Starvation, which I thought was a really, really good title. And it sort of wrote itself.
Do you write every day? Is that part of your...
I do. It's not always any good. In fact, mainly it's not. I'm not terribly prolific, but I never stop writing stuff. But I... Because I've heard it before, I get impatient with myself because I think, oh, I've heard that. Oh, that's no good. Oh, yeah, that's no... Oh, more of that old rubbish, is it? And then one day, something will come to mind that I haven't heard before. And I sort of go into a kind of trance, I suppose, and it might take a week or two, or sometimes it goes after a week or two and I just sort of lose interest in it, but if it's any good, it'll come back. But I go into a sort of a trance and I fiddle around with it until it's suddenly finished and I think that I've written a cover song. The ones that I think are good are ones that sound to me like, not actually like an actual song that I've ripped off, but it'll sound like I haven't had anything to do with it. And those are the ones that I think are good. If I hear my little tricks and little fancies and things that you do, if I hear that, I get real impatient with it and I don't like it. It's a very peculiar thing, writing songs, because you can't turn it on, neither can you turn it off. And sometimes well, when I was younger, I used to really freak if I couldn't write a song, you know, if I hadn't done for a while. I used to get really upset, mm-hmm. and then start forcing it out, and that's the worst thing you can possibly do.
So it's not forcing it out, but you still work at it.
Yeah, working at it is pleasurable. But forcing it is unspeakable. I'll give you an example if you like. I'll play you something which is just a real work in progress. It's just something which has got three bits. It's got three bits to it, and it doesn't really make sense. But there's a few bits and pieces that I would say could be good. The song's called "I'm on Your Plane," which is a weird title, like "I'm on your level" or something. You mm-hmm. know. But it goes like this. I'm on your plane. All at once I feel the connection, like we're going in the same direction home. I'm on your plane. I used to walk around all shabby and thin, like something that the cat brought in. So lonely was I, but darling, as you see, I'm eating again. The clouds are gone and there's the sun up in the sky. Hey girl, I've got a lot to thank you for. God bless the day you fetched up at my door. God knows It's got good and it's gonna get better. This is the kind of new love letter you already know. I'm on your plane. Like that.
It's lovely.
It's got possibilities, but it doesn't really sort of make much sense yet.
Mm-hmm. So you'll try and come up with a bridge, or do you think you've distinct parts that aren't fitting together?
I think the actual shape of it, I think the tune is good, and there's three parts. There's an A, B, and a C part, and they all seem to, I probably wouldn't write another part, but I might juggle, change one of the part or two of the parts to, so they're a bit different the second time they come around. That's how I feel that one would go.
And so you've always got some of those you're working on. What's your hit rate? You say some things you just abandon. How many songs would you write before you would have an album's worth, say?
Oh, God. My songs are all pretty short, so an album's worth is about 11 or 12 songs. I'd have to write about 30 to get 12 songs.
Is that right?
That I like. Well, something like that, because I always do a couple of covers, at least a couple of covers on most of my records.
When you were writing in the early 70s and you were with Brinsley Schwartz and you wrote a lot of the songs that became your hits later on, was writing the same back then for you?
It was when I hear that the early songs I wrote, I can really hear a kid, you know, starting to feel his way. You know, the way I always explain it is that, you know, we figured out that in order to have any staying power, we had to learn how to write songs. So a couple of us were into it, you know. And you start off writing your heroes, you know, catalogue. And it's very, very obvious that where it's come from. And then you'll move on to someone else and rewrite their catalogue and someone else after that and someone else after that until... one day you'll be writing your latest heroes catalogue, but you'll put a bit of the first person and a couple of bits from the third, and suddenly you'll find that it's not exactly like your latest hero. It's got something else about it because you put these other influences in, and that's the way it goes and goes and goes until suddenly you've got your own recipe, you know, like a palette.
Who was that first hero for you, the one you were imitating?
Well, I think at the time I joined my first band and I really got, you know, started to take it seriously, I think it was probably the band, I think. I loved the band. Crosby, Stills and Nash, people like that. You know, no one too obscure, you know, they're all pretty mainstream. It's only again when I got older, you know, I started hearing. I mean, I'd been a mod when I was a teenager, and so
Now we should explain what does that mean that you are.
Well, it was a sort of youth movement in the 60s, and they had a sort of fashion, you know, they liked wearing the right clothes and things. We used to ride on scooters, you know, on little Vespas and Lambrettas, and the music they listened to was all. American R&B, like Motown and Stax stuff from Memphis, and ska and blue beat and reggae music. And so I'd been a mod, so I thought that I knew quite a lot about cool music. You know how wrong I was, but you know, for a 17-year-old, you know, I was pretty, you know, I knew who. You know, Solomon Burke was, and Johnny Taylor and people like that. But I wasn't writing like that. I thought that was really, really hard to do, to write those kind of songs, which is strange because they're simple. They're really simple. And it's that's the hardest stuff to do is a real simple, direct message.
What was the first country music you liked? Because that's a big influence on you.
Yeah, it is. Well, that's much easier to answer. My father was in the RAF, and when I was a kid, I lived in the Middle East or wherever he was stationed, you know, in the Middle East or Germany, you know, Cyprus, Jordan. And they had... I did a lot of listening to records then, the family record collection, and my mother was very musical, and she had the you know, Sinatra and Nat King Cole and, you know, the stuff, South Pacific and Guys and Dolls and all that stuff, you know, soundtracks.
People forget back then, the soundtracks and Broadway shows.
Yeah, where all that. I
everybody
loved
had The
all.
King and I.
The King and I, absolutely. And so I loved all these records. But she had in her collection, very bizarrely, and she didn't know. When I got older, I asked her, where did you get those from? She had two 10-inch Tennessee Ernie Ford records. I just thought this is the greatest thing I'd ever heard. He had this fantastic voice, you know, which was like a Disney cartoon mm-hmm. character, like I'm the King of the Swingers, you know, like Louis, was it Louis Prima did that. But he had this beautiful sort of baritone voice. But it wasn't just that his records were so swinging. I didn't know it was country music. I could tell it was sort of some sort of hillbilly thing going on there, but they were playing with all these jazz chords in, and I didn't understand that was the sort of California version of country and western music. I'd never heard anything like this, and it sounded like that Tennessee, in my seven-year-old mind, sounded like Tennessee Ernie was really cool. I could see that because of what the clothes he was wearing on the covers of these records.
What was he wearing?
California casual pool wear.
Right. He was never a cowboy.
He was. If he did, it was a sort of stuff that real cowboys didn't quite wear, you know, like a tasseled suede jacket or something like that.
Might have got himself beaten up on the ranch.
It might have done, but he looked so cool. He looked so cool. But also, it sounded to me like his mates who were playing on this record were also really cool. So they made each other sound cool because they were hanging out with Tennessee and obviously were doing what he said. But Tennessee was cool enough to know these people who could make this fantastic noise. So that's the first thing I heard that really, really blew my mind, I thought. And it was so swinging.
And then what your first instrument was it a guitar?
Well, I had a little plastic sort of ukulele that my grandma bought me. And then I got another that I sat on that, I think, or somebody did anyway. But I got another one. It was like a banjo version, same sort of thing. But it had an amazing little gadget that you clipped onto the neck, came separate, and you had elastic bands or something, and it had push buttons on it, and where each button was, it had a little cord window. But you pressed the buttons down, and it made. Underneath it pressed the strings down in the right place. So you effectively just playing the. So it gave me an ear for how, you know, which chords would go with, especially with simple songs like Lonnie Donegan was the guy that from my generation was the fellow that we all copied because he played very simple songs. They were sort of lead belly songs and, you know, work songs and folk songs really, but they had this great swinging drive to them because they were jazz players who played on his records, but they were very simple and very easy to learn. And it wasn't too long before I thought, this is a bit uncool pressing the buttons down. You know, I'm going to figure out where my fingers actually go, you know.
How then did it become your dream to become a musician from pressing a button on a plastic guitar?
Well, I didn't really want to become a musician more than I wanted to be famous. That was my first drive, and have lots of people telling me I was marvelous. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize there was going to be any work involved in it.
Yeah,
and
you thought just the hair. This and, is enough.
Yeah, I had the hair.
People have gone very far.
That was the start.
Like yeah.
Yes, and being you know any kind of believing that I was any kind of artist was far from my thoughts and still is really, you know, I think of myself really as an artisan sort of more than an artist, you know. I make artistic decisions, but I think I'm a hack really and proud of it, you know. I'll have a go at doing anything, you know, jingles, you know, I'll have a shot at anything. But I make sort of artistic decisions along the way, really. But
and then, how did that start for you? Did you drop out of school? Were you?
I went to quite a good school actually, but I wasn't very good academically gifted. I had a facility for English and writing, and I thought I might be a journalist, actually. And I can remember these guys who had definitely been in the war, in the Second World War, war correspondents. You know, they'd come out to these trouble spots, and they'd come and stay with us because my dad, who was station commander of these places, he was quite high up, would make sure they had the right accreditations and papers and all that stuff, passes, you know, to go to these areas. And they used to stay at the house, and I really liked these guys. You know, there was something about them. I liked the way they drank and smoked, you know, and the way they talked and laughed with each other, easy sort of camaraderie. Mm-hmm. Also their clothes as well. I loved their clothes that they had. Well, very well worn, you know. Mm-hmm. And I thought I wanted to be one of those people. And I got this job at a paper as editorial assistant, making tea, sweeping up, filing copy. Occasionally they'd give me a movie at the local flea pit. I'd go down and review it. It was a real break for someone like me, you know, to get into. And I'd been there about 6 months, I suppose, and I realised that I didn't have what it took. These fellows were really fantastic. It was only a local paper, mm-hmm. but they were really good. And I realised that I didn't really have what it took to do that. My dreams of being in a foxhole with a mud-spattered Remington, you know, wearing a steel helmet with a cigar stub clamped in my teeth, you know, knocking out the copy, you know, with the incoming, was just ridiculous. You know, it was never going to happen. And then I got a call from Brinsley Schwartz, who said, come and join my band.
Mm-hmm. And you knew him from school?
From school. I went to school with him, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then you started playing. When did the writing start?
Fairly soon after I joined. Again, I really messed things up for them, really, because when I joined the group, they were on Parlophone, which was the Beatles label. In those days, anyone really who could knock out two or three chords and had a kit of drums got a record deal. It was very, very, very easy to get a record deal. But still with Parlophone, that was something else. That was the Beatles label, and they got this deal. They didn't play on their own records, which was very common then. They had session people playing on the comms, and on the record. But they sang. And when I joined the group, you know, I figured that I was way more hip than they were. And I said, we can't have this, and we've got to play on our own records, you know. This, and actually, the records that they did with the session men playing sounded fantastic. Mm-hmm. But
you didn't know about the Monkees back then. You thought they played their own instruments.
No, exactly. And so I said, no, we've got to play our own stuff. And so then we've very soon got fired as soon as we. As soon as we started playing on our own records.
I thought after the Beatles, it was understood that musicians had to play on their own records. That was part of their appeal. Well, that didn't change?
Well, the Beatles were, you know, this was 1968 when I joined them. The Beatles hadn't released their White Album then. They were still actually going, you know. Mm-hmm. So it was a huge scandal when this story broke. That not that our group had session men, but that most pop groups mm-hmm. had session people playing on their records. It was, you know, people couldn't believe it.
We'll be right back after this quick break. We're back with more of Bruce's conversation with Nick Lowe.
But you had a period where you wrote a lot of sort of your, what would later become big hits for you. You wrote So It Goes and...
Oh, that was really much later. The first thing I wrote, which was really good, was an original idea, as I've said before, because people have asked me about it, is a song called What's So Funny About Peace, Love and Understanding. And I remember the day I had the idea for it. I thought, I couldn't believe it, that I'd actually had an original idea that I hadn't stolen.
Where did it come from?
What was the
genesis of it?
I suppose the genesis of it was sort of funny. I was, because the hippie dream was sort of dying. I suppose this was about 1971, I thought of this. And the hippie dream was sort of dying, and people who had been hippies were started, had rediscovered alcohol, you know, and were rather embarrassed that they'd dabbled with this thing, and they were deserting the sinking ship in droves. And I suppose the idea for the song was a diehard hippie saying to all his followers, or all the people who were in his commune, you know, who are now leaving, well, you think I'm an old has-been, but you can't deny that peace, love, and understanding is what we should all be looking for, you know. And you're sniggering at it and laughing at it, but what's so funny about it? When it comes down to it, what's so funny about it? And that was the idea for the song, and I thought, well, it's a bit of a mouthful, but it's a really great title. What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? Because people did used to do that. Oh yeah, man, you know, do the peace sign, you know, right, as a, you know, oh, peace and love, man. Mm-hmm. In this rather sort of annoying tone of voice, you know, that they'd adopt. So it was a sort of funny song, really.
Well, it's a song about peace the most cynical person can enjoy.
But the surprising thing, looking back now from this distance, is that I can remember also having a very mature thought, which, when I think back to how I was in those days, I didn't have a single mature thought, going for me at all. But in this case, I did. And that was not to mess it up by trying to explain about an old hippie, you know, and, I, you know, I'm just an old hippie. What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? I thought, No, this is a really, really good idea. Don't just let the title do the work for you and write a really simple verse. Doesn't matter if it's cliches about walking the wicked world, searching for light in the darkness, you know, and all that old nonsense. It doesn't matter. The title is really strong. The tune is strong. Don't mess it up, you know, with some of your clever nonsense. That is an amazingly mature thing to do. And the result is that song has been covered by I don't know how many people. It almost feels like I really have had nothing to do with it, because everybody knows. It's never actually been a hit, but everybody knows that song.
Can you play it for us now?
Oh, yeah, sure. I tend to do it in a sort of slow tempo, but once again, you know, I'm sorry about my croaky voice, but I'll do my best.
As I walk this wicked world, searching for light in the darkness of insanity, I ask myself, is all hope lost? Is there only pain, hatred, and misery? And each time I feel like this inside, there's one thing I want to know. What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? So funny about peace, love, and understanding. And as I walk on through troubled times, my
My spirit gets so downhearted sometimes. Where are the strong? Who are the trusted? And where is the harmony? And each time I feel it slipping away, it just makes me wanna cry. What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? So funny about peace, love, and understanding. Ooh, where are the strong? Who are the trusting? The harmony, sweet harmony. 'Cause each time I feel it slipping away, you know, it just makes me wanna cry. What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? Understanding. Understanding, brother. Understanding, sister. Understanding.
That's beautiful. When you tripped over one word, you're probably expecting the crowd just to rise up and sing it back to you.
Yes, they've come to your rescue.
It had a huge effect on your career long after you wrote it, which is it made you financially independent, I suppose. Can you tell that story?
I think you're probably referring to the Bodyguard record. Yeah, it that was a real stroke of luck. Yes, I was in the middle of trying to figure out quite a lot of things. Really, I mean, my career as a sort of pop star was over. You know, I wasn't young anymore. And you can sort of tell. I suppose because I'd been a record producer as well, and sort of yucked it up in the boardroom, you know, with people, you know, the people at the record company, as well as being an artiste myself, I'd seen both sides of it. I was very aware of when the signs that the public had got tired of my act, you know. Because I was tired of it as well. It seemed really exhausted, and I was, you know, I was drinking and all those cliches. I was drinking quite heavily and all that, and I was just exhausted. I didn't like my records and, you know, what I was doing. Anyway, I got myself sort of cleaned up, and then I started, when my head cleared, you know, I started to think, well, how can I move things along now? Because I'm going to get older. And I don't feel like I've done anything really, really good yet. I want to be able to say I've written at least half a dozen really, really good songs. And I don't think I have yet. I think I've got it in me too. But the drink and the late nights and all the rest of it have taken their toll. And that's spoilt a lot of stuff. So I'm going to develop a new act, you know. And so I did, and I came up with this pretty good record, the best record I'd made for a while, called The Impossible Bird. made it on a real shoestring budget with a lot of, called in a lot of favors. And I was, you know, even so, I was effectively broke. And all of a sudden, I knew that they were going to use this song in a movie. And I was pleased, you know, there'd be a few dollars in it. You know, not bad, actually, a nice payday, a few grand. And it's come out and it's sold. And Curtis Stigers, who, you know, was a big pop star then, he'd recorded this song, Peace, Love and Understanding. And this movie came out. It was a big hit. And all of a sudden, it's on, there's a soundtrack album and it sold 3 million, 4 million, 5 million. And when it sold about 8 million, I thought I'd better get in touch with old Curtis, you know, and say, what happened? You know, I mean, thanks very much. I definitely owe you a drink here. As far as I know, I've never actually seen the film. I feel as if I have, because I've tried to watch it a few times. But I'm not even sure if it's actually in the film. If it is, it's playing on a car radio somewhere in the mm-hmm. background. But anyway, it's on the soundtrack record.
Which I think ended up selling 40 million.
It did. 8 million. That was just early days. It mm-hmm. went up and up and up and up until, even though I got, I don't know, I don't even know how much, less than a cent. You know, I don't know what my share was, but it was after it goes up there, you know, to those quantities, you do the math, as they say. Mm-hmm. And I got this succession of massive checks through, and they could not have come at a better time for me, because not only was I able to pay my boys, you know, who had done all this great work for me for nothing, pretty much, I could pay them. I could go into the United States, where I still had this fabulous audience, but they were waiting for something to happen. I could go and see them, show them this new style that I wanted, this slightly more grown-up style I wanted to show them, that would suit my advancing years in the pop business. Because up to that point, there weren't that many people of advanced years in pop music. Now you can't move for them. Mm. There's plenty of them. The buggers won't get out of the way.
Yeah.
But then,
they're still doing everything they did when they were 23.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to avoid that, you know, because mm-hmm. I thought, oh, that'll be just too undignified, you know, and preaching to the converted and all that. I wanted to bring a new, younger audience along, as well as the old people, you know, because I liked Johnny Cash's audience. I thought his audiences were fantastic. He had all age groups, so all digging it. So, but anyway, I was able, with this money, this windfall, to take the boys over, to have a decent bus for us to tour in the US, and to stay at decent hotels, not top of the range, but decent, where we wouldn't get our stuff stolen, you know. And also to make another album on the proceeds of it, which also did well. And Dig My Mood, yeah. Mm-hmm. And to pay off some debts, you know. And of course, once people see you've got something going on, you know, then you're the initial windfall from the bodyguard, you spend all that, but it's suddenly there's mm-hmm. everything starts getting groovier for you, and people start coming looking for songs. And so I got a few covers off those records and things. So and that really allowed me to lift off, you know, and probably is the reason why I'm fortunate enough to be sitting here talking to you mm-hmm. today.
I want to ask you a little bit about producing, because as you became well known as a songwriter and with Brinsley Schwartz and then with Rockpile, you became the in-house producer at Stiff.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I mean, the most famously you worked with Elvis Costello and Graham Parker. I don't know in what order you worked with them, who you worked with first. Tell me first about how did you work with Graham Parker? How did you?
Well, Graham, yeah. When Graham formed his group, The Rumor, they was formed, first of all, he was managed by an ex-manager of the group that I'd been, Brinsley Schwartz. Mm-hmm. He also had two members of Brinsley Schwartz in the group, plus the other guitar player had been had worked for us. So he was a roadie for the Brinsleys for quite a long while, and a very good friend of the band, mm-hmm. Martin Belmont. But I was really pleased because I thought Graham was so good. And
what was it about his songs that you liked so much at first?
Well, they sounded really mature. You know, they were really mature songs, and they were, you know, he'd clearly been listening to really good stuff. You could see his influences and things, but he had these, you know, really great influences, I thought, because they were the same influences as I had, you know. So, of course, I thought he had excellent taste. But they were very good musicians. They had a great rhythm section as well. Steve Golding and Andy Bodnar, who I got to play on a few of my records as well. And then I think after that, I think Elvis Costello came next. Mm-hmm. He was signed to Stiff originally as a writer. But after they listened to his tape in depth, you know, they said, well, actually, this guy's a bit more fantastic than that. Mm-hmm. So
did you think that as well?
No, I didn't really. I knew him. I knew him. Declan. I knew him as Declan McManus. And I did know him because he used to come and see Brinsley Schwartz. Whenever we played in Liverpool, he used to, or up the northwest of England, he would come along, and we noticed him because he looked so unusual. One day, actually, we were playing at the Cavern Club, where famously the Beatles started out. We were playing at the Cavern, and we were having a drink in the pub across the road. Both are gone now, of course, both the Cavern and the pub, the Grapes, I think it was called, across the road, before our show. And in came this fellow. I said, look, there's that guy who comes to see us play. I'm going to go and buy him a drink. You know, I think probably it's a time, you know. And he says that he approached me at the bar and bought me a drink. I don't know. But either way, that's where we met for the first time. And he had a group in the pub rock scene that was going on in London at that time. The Brinsleys were in, and Graham and the Rumour. And, well, Graham sort of was in it. They were a bit too good for that, really. But Dire Straits, actually, were a pub rock band as mm-hmm. well. Where are they now?
No idea.
So I got the job. To start with, I was definitely in charge. You know, look here, kid, you know, you do this and do that. And on his first album, that's the one and only record I did with Elvis. I did five or six albums, I can't remember now. But that was the one and only one where nominally I was in charge. You know, I suppose I had the last word, but it really didn't take long before I realized that he really was something else, and I'd be very foolish to override him. You know, sometimes he'd come up with these really kind of crackpot ideas, you know, and I'd say no, and then as I was about to say no, I suddenly found it turning into yes. Mm-hmm. and next thing I know, I was tugging my forelock, as they say, you know, saying, good morning, Mr. Costello, what would you like to do today? And so our roles reversed. I mean, I was very much, you know, he called the shots, and I enabled him to do it.
We'll be right back with more from Nick Lowe after the break. We're back with the rest of Bruce's interview with Nick Lowe.
I want to talk more about songwriting, so can we hear another new song?
Yeah, okay, yeah.
You played a beautiful song called Blue on Blue.
Oh, I can do that. That was the one I was thinking of, yeah.
Okay, I'd love to hear that.
Okay, here we go.
Blue on blue, I've got a message in a song for you. You're like a mill, you run me through. I call you blue on blue. Blue on blue, you're only happy when you see me cry. I ought to leave, but how can I?
this is my one true desire. I long each waking hour for you. Blue on blue, I've got a message in a song for you. I call you blue on blue. Promises you don't keep. I wanna run, but I'm in too deep for blue on blue. In my mind, I'm on the end of a ball of twine that she jerks from time to time. Time for blue on. Has it come to this? Your kiss is my one true desire. I long each waking hour for you. Blue on blue, I've got a message in a song for you. You're like a meal, you run me through. I call you blue on.
Can you tell me about the writing of that song?
I can't really, no. I just sort of made it up one day. I was on holiday in Italy and just sort of was sitting around in the heat, in the dark, in one afternoon, and just messing around with the guitar. And that, you know, simple little chord figure came out. But I seemed to be able to get it to roll into the other parts, you know, that was... It will go in and out of time. Mm-hmm. You never kind of know what key it's in either. It sort of starts off in one key and it sort of changes into another and then changes back again. And this sort of rolling thing I thought was quite interesting. And I thought Blue on Blue is a pretty good title, which I kept on. I was making noises to start with, like you do. Blue, 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 you know, and it turns into... You find yourself saying blue on blue, and then you'll think, what are you saying? Blue on blue. That's actually pretty good. Mm-hmm. And it just sort of felt right.
It's funny you mentioned the rolling in that song. When you go into the, I guess it's a bridge part, there's this tension until you go back into the kind of the...
I'm ever so pleased that you make a comment like that. Nothing cheers me up more than mm-hmm. to hear.
Well, it's almost a little nervous. I get a little nervous in the bridge waiting for it to come back. And then it loops in. I think you just do the second half of the chord changes at
yes,
that point, don't
that's
you?
That's right, yes.
And yeah, just this huge relief comes over me when I'm listening to that. And thank God he's back. It's also one of those, it's one of those chord progressions. It could just go on forever.
Yeah. Yes. There's nothing very original about it at all, except the way that the structure mm-hmm. takes it.
Well, it feels like it's still going. I always think some Van Morrison songs are like that.
Yeah,
it's like
yeah.
it's going all the time. We just dip in and listen to 3 minutes of it, and then we dip out. But it's still going, you know, even now.
Well, I must say it's a song that I really really like doing, and especially doing with the. With the Straitjackets, they've brought it up, you know, and it sounds really cool when they do it.
You've been very generous. There are two things I do want to ask you about before you go. We talked about country music earlier and your great love for country music. You then married into country music royalty. What was it like? This is the music you loved, and then suddenly June Carter is your mother-in-law, and Johnny Cash is your, I guess, your stepfather-in-law. Mm. What was that like?
It was unbelievably great. I couldn't believe my luck, even though, they were so kind to me. Both of them, Johnny and June, I absolutely adored them. But still, it was Johnny Cash. You know, I used to, every time I met him, there was a good 15 minutes when I was with him that I could barely speak because he was so charismatic. It almost sucked the air out of the room. The only other person I've met like that was Solomon Burke. But John had this effect on me every time I'd meet him until, you know, as I say, about 10 or 15 minutes had passed. And then he was such a lovely guy. I've got, you know, tons of stories I could tell about him, including him, the time that he and June came to stay with me and Carleen in when we lived in Shepherd's Bush, which is now quite a smart part of London, but back then was funky. You know, it was dead funky. It was an Irish part of town. And of course, the Irish loved John and June. And John wouldn't go anywhere out without being dressed up as Johnny Cash. You know, he didn't know, there was no sweats and baseball cap pulled down low or anything like that. He had the black frock coat, the boots and everything. He was, "Hi, I'm Johnny Cash," you know, and walking out in Shepherd's Bush with him and June in a sort of mink coat with a mink hat on and some incredible jeweled brooch, you know, and saying hi to everyone. Oh, my God, it was terrific. So funny and cheered everybody up. You know, all these Irish people say, "Ah, Johnny, what about you?" You know, shouting at him. It was great. And getting up in the morning, we had a nice little house. I mean, it was a funky little house then, but now the house is probably worth about $4 million because the area's gone
because
right
Johnny
up.
Cash stayed there.
And Johnny Cash stayed. It actually belonged to Tony Visconti. I bought it from Tony Visconti. Okay. He used to live there. And,
did you ever talk music with Johnny Cash?
Yes, that's what I was going to say, actually, because he liked nothing better, especially in this house of ours in Shepherd's Bush. I can remember on occasion when he was such a music fan, and we'd open a bottle of wine and you know, have a few glasses of wine, and we'd start playing records. He'd play records to me. He played me stuff. He turned me on to things like Ferlin Husky and Johnny Horton, who was a good friend of him. You know, he played me fantastic stuff, and he was like a fan. You know, listen to this one, you know, and couldn't quite get in the groove, especially after he'd had three or four glasses of wine. You know, it goes grrt, grrt, you know, scratching the record. This is fantastic, this is great. You know, he just like a music fan does. And you'd forget that it's Johnny Cash, and you're listening to records with John. Now, I mean, I just think it's just such a fantastic memory, you know. But back then, I sort of took it for granted. I can't believe that I did. But he was the super, super guy. And I still miss him. I still do. Think about him all the time, and June.
And
wonderful.
What was she like?
Oh, beautiful, funny, kind, never a sort of a bottomless well of patience she was with, especially with John, who was quite a could be quite a handful at time. I never saw him when he was mean, you know, and I believe he was mean. I never, ever saw him mean, but I saw him when he was out of sorts sometimes, you know. But he was always really funny and lovely.
That's a scary father-in-law.
Well, yeah,
lots
I
of
suppose
us have scary father-in-laws.
I suppose he was. Yeah, right. I suppose he was. Yeah.
One more story, which I've read about, but it talks about this collision between sort of the world you inhabited with Rockpile and Brinsley Schwartz, and the much bigger world, which is. I don't know if it was the first time, but the time you met Keith Richards. which I've read about and just seems completely ridiculous to me. So could you tell a little bit of that story?
Well, it was ridiculous. Yes, it was when Rockpile really were, we coulda, shoulda, woulda made it. You know, we were really poised to be very successful indeed, but we were inherently a lazy band. We played the same set for three glorious years, you know. Mm-hmm. But there was those things that made people like us in a way. The fact they could see we were having such a laugh, you know, we didn't take it seriously, you know, we were having such a great time. We had a little run of shows at the Bottom Line, the much loved and lamented Bottom Line. Mm-hmm. And we were playing there in the middle of this little run of shows. It was the night after Keith got out of jail in Canada. And for some reason, this rumor...
We should explain. I think it was heroin possession or some drug thing.
I couldn't possibly comment on that.
Okay.
Something, you know, that Keith had got up to. I think it was something like that. But
we'll phone the RCMP, see what we can
I think it's
determine.
Pretty well documented anyway. But anyway, he got out of jail and for some reason he decided to come and see Rockpile. Why, I know not.
And it was the day after he got out of
jail? It was the day after he got out of jail. I'm sure I can think of plenty of things I'd rather do after I got out of a Canadian jail.
You got him through that experience.
I'd like to think I helped. Anyway, of course, he couldn't believe it. You know, that he'd want to come. We heard this rumor, you know. And we were in the little cramped dressing rooms that were at the back of the Bottom Line. And in walked Barbara Sharon, a well-known publicist and writer at that time. Anyway, she walked into the dressing room. She said, "I'm here." She says, "I'm here with Keith." And we'd sort of heard a bit of a rumpus out in the audience. You know, they were very, very excitable audience because they knew what they were getting. But when this word went round that Keith Richard was coming down, I mean, you could feel it coming through the walls, you know. People were so excited. Anyway, Keith, she said, "Can I bring him, you know, can he come and play, do you think?" And we said, "Well, of course he can, yeah." But the funny thing was that we were all keen except for Edmonds, because Edmonds had been in the top band in Wales in the 1960s, like 1961, 62. They're in the top band in Wales. And along comes this band from London to do a little tour with them through the Welsh valleys, and they're doing the same sort of music, Chuck Berry music, you know, and it's the Stones, and Edmonds said, "Oh, they were rubbish," you know, so Edmonds wasn't pleased, and he was all for saying, "Oh no, I don't want him in here, no, tell him to tell him to clear off," and we were, you know, really keen. It was almost impossible not to be carried along with this. It was overpowering, you know, the audience expectation.
So you're on stage, you're looking back and forth at the two of them, hoping it's not a fight, or?
Well, they just go, I don't think Keith could care less, you know, but but Edmonds just glowered at him all night, you know. But he started, you know, he got on stage, he started turning up the wrong amp. You know, we had our amps on, so it's quite squashed. And I suddenly found my I was playing bass, you know, and then suddenly the bass got louder and louder and louder. And then I thought, what the hell's happening here? You know, and then super twangy, you know, twang, 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 twang. And then it sounded really deep, like reggae basses. And, woo, boom, boom. And I look around and Keith is trying to adjust his own guitar, but he's on my knobs, you know, adjusting my man. So it was
he couldn't understand why his wasn't getting louder. He couldn't understand his wasn't getting any louder.
Yeah, he couldn't understand why he was louder and he was turning everything up, you know. So it was, he tried to stay on with us, you know, because we just pressed on, you know, we tried to get him off, you know, at the end of it. Right, thank you very much, Keith Richards. Yeah, thank you, Keith. You know, and he wasn't going anywhere. You know, he just stood there sort of swaying backwards and forwards.
Did he know any of your songs? Could he?
He had a go. He had a go, but it was really, really hopeless. And it got old pretty quick, you know. You could tell that the audience weren't digging it nearly as much as they were when he stepped on the stage.
How many songs did he stay for?
I think about three, maybe four. maybe four. And then we had a tour manager who had a real sort of English sort of manner, sort of, really? Is that, oh, could I possibly? Do you mind awfully if I, he was very, very, you know, he had that corny English thing, you know, going, Jeeves sort of thing. And he eventually, I won't tell you what Edmonds actually said to call him out, you know, and tell him and get Keith off, but it wasn't very polite. And there was this great sight of our tour manager, Des, sort of taking him gently by the arm, you know, and just leading him, whilst taking his guitar off him and putting it, you know, putting it away and just leading him gently off the stage, which I'm sure he was quite pleased to, to have gone.
Was he but there
the crowd, I seem to remember the crowd was actually not too bad. I mean, I think they realised that he wasn't really in any condition to do it, but... they'd given him a nice clap, but it was sort of such a weird night.
And have you seen him since?
Did Keith?
Yes.
No.
Was he there when you finished? Did he?
No, never.
He wasn't backstage.
No. He'd gone by the time we got off.
Yeah.
No, I that didn't surprise me at all. It was, you know, it was quite beastly in there, and of course the entourage that he had with him were, you know, taking up quite a lot of room.
But Dave Edmonds was pretty happy.
He was delighted, yeah. Oh, boy, we had a laugh about that. But, it was one of those things, it's a great experience in retrospect. It's been a good story.
Thank you so much for everything. Well, I've taken so much of your time. You've been really generous playing.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I hope so. Well, thank you.
Thanks to Nick Lowe for playing for us and talking to Bruce about his creative process and career. Be sure to check out BrokenRecordPodcast.com for a playlist full of Nick Lowe's songs, as well as some of our favorite songs that he's produced over the years. You can also subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/BrokenRecordPodcast. Broken Record is produced with help from Jason Gambrell, Milo Bell, Leo Rose, and Martin Gonzalez of Pushkin Industries. Our theme music's by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond. Thanks for listening.